they understood. "Do you mean that you are refusing to obey the law?" asked the judge. "No, I am complying with the law, to the letter. Your law holds that my life, my work, and my property may be disposed of without my consent. Very well, you may now dispose of me without my participation in the matter. I will not play the part of defending myself where no defense is possible, and I will not simulate the illusion of dealing with the tribunal of justice." "But, Mr. Reardon, the law provides specifically that you are to be given an opportunity to present your side of the case and to defend yourself." "A prisoner brought to trial can defend himself only if there is an objective principle of justice recognized by his judges, a principle upholding his rights, which they may not violate, and which he can invoke. The law by which you are trying me holds that there are no principles, that I have no rights, and that you may do with me whatever you please." "Very well, do it."
"Mr. Reardon, the law which you are denouncing is based on the highest principle, the principle of the public good."
"Who is the public? What does it hold as its good?" "There was a time when men believed that the good was a concept to be defined by a code of moral values, and that no man had the right to seek his good through the violation of the rights of another. If it is now believed that my fellow men may sacrifice me in any manner they please for the sake of whatever they deem to be their own good, if they believe that they may seize my property simply because they need it, well, so does any burglar. There is only this difference. The burglar does not ask me to sanction his act." A group of seats at the side of the courtroom was reserved for the prominent visitors who had come from New York to witness the trial. Dagny sat motionless, and her face showed nothing but a solemn attention, the attention of listening with the knowledge that the flow of his words would determine the course of her life. Eddie Willers sat beside her. James Taggart had not come. Paul Larkin sat hunched forward, his face thrust out, pointed like an animal's muzzle, sharpened by a look of fear, now turning into malicious hatred. Mr. Moen, who sat beside him, was a man of greater innocence and smaller understanding. His fear was of a simpler nature. He listened in bewildered indignation, and he whispered to Larkin,
"Good God, now he's done it. Now he'll convince the whole country that all businessmen are enemies of the public good."
"Are we to understand," asked the judge, "that you hold your own interests above the interests of the public? I hold that such a question can never arise, except in a society of cannibals."
What do you mean?"
"I hold that there is no clash of interests among men who do not demand the unearned, and who do not practice human sacrifices."
"Are we to understand that if the public deems it necessary to curtail your profits, you do not recognize its right to do so?"
"Why, yes, I do. The public may curtail my profits any time it wishes, by refusing to buy my product."
"We are speaking of other methods."
"Any other method of curtailing profits is the method of looters, and I recognize it as such."
"Mr. Reardon, this is hardly the way to defend yourself."
"I said that I would not defend myself."
"But this is unheard of. Do you realize the gravity of the charge against you?"
"I do not care to consider it."
"Do you fully realize the possible consequences of your stand?"
"Fully."
"It is the opinion of this court that the facts presented by the prosecution seem to warrant no leniency. The penalty which this court has the power to impose on you is extremely severe."
"Go ahead."
"I beg your pardon?"
"Impose it." The three judges looked at one another. Then their spokesman turned back to Reardon.
"This is unprecedented," he said.
"It is completely irregular," said the second judge. "The law requires you to submit a plea in your own defense. Your only alternative is to state for the record that you throw yourself upon the mercy of the court."
"I do not."
"But you have to."
"Do you mean that what you expect from me is some sort of voluntary action?"
"Yes."
"I volunteer nothing."
"But the law demands that the defendant's side be represented on the record."
"Do you mean that you need my help to make this procedure legal?"
"Well, no. Yes. That is, to complete the form."
"I will not help you." The third and youngest judge, who had acted as prosecutor, snapped impatiently,
"This is ridiculous and unfair. Do you want to let it look as if a man of your prominence had been railroaded without a—"
He cut himself off short. Somebody at the back of the courtroom emitted a long whistle. "I want," said Reardon gravely,
to let the nature of this procedure appear exactly for what it is. If you need my help to disguise it, I will not help you.
But we are giving you a chance to defend yourself, and it is you who are rejecting it.
I will not help you to pretend that I have a chance. I will not help you to preserve an appearance of righteousness where rights are not recognized. I will not help you to preserve an appearance of rationality by entering a debate in which a gun is the final argument. I will not help you to pretend that you are administering justice.
But the law compels you to volunteer a defense.
There was laughter at the back of the courtroom. That is the flaw in your theory, gentlemen, said Reardon gravely. And I will not help you out of it. If you choose to deal with men by means of compulsion, do so. But you will discover that you need the voluntary cooperation of your victims in many more ways than you can see at present. And your victims should discover that it is their own volition, which you cannot force, that makes you possible. I choose to be consistent, and I will obey you in the manner you demand. Whatever you wish me to do, I will do it at the point of a gun. If you sentence me to jail, you will have to send armed men to carry me there. I will not volunteer to move. If you fine me, you will have to seize my property to collect the fine. I will not volunteer to pay it. If you believe that you have the right to force me, use your guns openly. I will not help you to disguise the nature of your action. The eldest judge leaned forward across the table, and his voice became suavely derisive.
You speak as if you were fighting for some sort of principle, Mr. Reardon. But what you're actually fighting for is only your property, isn't it?
Yes, of course, I am fighting for my property. Do you know the kind of principle that represents?
You pose as a champion of freedom, but it's only the freedom to make money that you're after.
Yes, of course, all I want is the freedom to make money. Do you know what that freedom implies?
Surely, Mr. Reardon, you wouldn't want your attitude to be misunderstood. You wouldn't want to give support to the widespread impression that you were a man devoid of social conscience, who feels no concern for the welfare of his fellows and works for nothing but his own profit.
I work for nothing but my own profit. I earn it.
There was a gasp, not of indignation, but of astonishment in the crowd behind him, and silence from the judges he faced. He went on calmly.
No, I do not want my attitude to be misunderstood. I shall be glad to state it for the record. I am in full agreement with the facts of everything said about me in the newspapers. With the facts, but not with the evaluation. I work for nothing but my own profit, which I make by selling a product they need to men who are willing and able to buy it. I do not produce it for their benefit at the expense of mine, and they do not buy it for my benefit at the expense of theirs. I do not sacrifice my interests to them, nor do they sacrifice theirs to me. We deal as equals, by mutual consent, to mutual advantage. And I am proud of every penny that I have earned in this manner. I am rich, and I am proud of every penny I own. I made my money by my own effort, in free exchange, and through the voluntary consent of every man I dealt with. The voluntary consent of those who employed me when I started. The voluntary consent of those who work for me now. The voluntary consent of those who buy my product. I shall answer all the questions you are afraid to ask me openly. Do I wish to pay my workers more than their services are worth to me? I do not. Do I wish to sell my product for less than my customers are willing to pay me? I do not. Do I wish to sell it at a loss or give it away? I do not. If this is evil, do whatever you please about me according to whatever standards you hold. These are mine. I am earning my own living as every honest man must. I refuse to accept as guilt the fact of my own existence and the fact that I must work in order to support it. I refuse to accept as guilt the fact that I am able to do it and do it well. I refuse to accept as guilt the fact that I am able to do it better than most people, the fact that my work is of greater value than the work of my neighbors and that more men are willing to pay me. I refuse to apologize for my ability. I refuse to apologize for my success. I refuse to apologize for my money. If this is evil, make the most of it. If this is what the public finds harmful to its interests, let the public destroy me. This is my code, and I will accept no other. I could say to you that I have done more good for my fellow men than you can ever hope to accomplish. But I will not say it, because I do not seek the good of others as a sanction for my right to exist. Nor do I recognize the good of others as a justification for their seizure of my property or their destruction of my life. I will not say that the good of others was the purpose of my work. My own good was my purpose, and I despise the man who surrenders his. I could say to you that you do not serve the public good, that nobody's good can be achieved at the price of human sacrifice, that when you violate the rights of one man, you have violated the rights of all, and a public of rightless creatures is doomed to destruction. I could say to you that you will and can achieve nothing but universal devastation, as any looter must when he runs out of victims. I could say it, but I won't. It is not your particular policy that I challenge, but your moral premise. If it were true that men could achieve their good by means of turning some men into sacrificial animals, and I were asked to immolate myself for the sake of creatures who wanted to survive at the price of my blood, if I were asked to serve the interests of society apart from, above, and against my own, I would refuse. I would reject it as the most contemptible evil. I would fight it with every power I possess. I would fight the whole of mankind. If 1 minute were all I could last before I were murdered, I would fight in the full confidence of the justice of my battle and of a living being's right to exist. Let there be no misunderstanding about me. If it is now the belief of my fellow men who call themselves the public that their good requires victims, then I say the public good be damned. I will have no part of it. The crowd burst into applause. Reardon whirled around, more startled than his judges. He saw faces that laughed in violent excitement, and faces that pleaded for help. He saw their silent despair breaking out into the open. He saw the same anger and indignation as his own, finding release in the wild defiance of their cheering. He saw the looks of admiration and the looks of hope. There were also the faces of loose-mouthed young men and maliciously unkempt females, the kind who led the booing in newsreel theaters at any appearance of a businessman on the screen. They did not attempt a counter-demonstration. They were silent. As he looked at the crowd, people saw in his face what the threats of the judges had not been able to evoke, the first sign of emotion. It was a few moments before they heard the furious beating of a gavel upon the table and one of the judges yelling, "Or I shall have the courtroom cleared!" As he turned back to the table, Reardon's eyes moved over the visitor section. His glance paused on Dagny, a pause perceptible only to her, as if he were saying, "It works." She would have appeared calm, except that her eyes seemed to have become too large for her face. Eddie Willers was smiling the kind of smile that is a man's substitute for breaking into tears. Mr. Moen looked stupefied. Paul Larkin was staring at the floor. There was no expression on Bertram Scudder's face, or on Lillian's. She sat at the end of a row, her legs crossed, a mink stole slanting from her right shoulder to her left hip. She looked at Reardon, not moving. In the complex violence of all the things he felt, he had time to recognize a touch of regret and of longing. There was a face he had hoped to see, had looked for from the start of the session, had wanted to be present more than any other face around him. But Francisco D'Anconia had not come.
"Mr. Reardon," said the eldest judge, smiling affably, reproachfully, and spreading his arms. "It is regrettable that you should have misunderstood us so completely. That's the trouble, that businessmen refuse to approach us in a spirit of trust and friendship. They seem to imagine that we are their enemies. Why do you speak of human sacrifices? What made you go to such an extreme? We have no intention of seizing your property or destroying your life. We do not seek to harm your interests. We are fully aware of your distinguished achievements. Our purpose is only to balance social pressures and do justice to all. This hearing is really intended not as a trial, but as a friendly discussion aimed at mutual understanding and cooperation."
I do not cooperate at the point of a gun.
"Why speak of guns? This matter is not serious enough to warrant such references. We are fully aware that the guilt in this case lies chiefly with Mr. Kenneth Daniger, who instigated this infringement of the law, who exerted pressure upon you, and who confessed his guilt by disappearing in order to escape trial."
"No, we did it by equal, mutual, voluntary agreement."
"Mr. Reardon," said the second judge, "you may not share some of our ideas, but when all is said and done, we're all working for the same cause, for the good of the people. We realize that you were prompted to disregard legal technicalities by the critical situation of the coal mines and the crucial importance of fuel to the public welfare."
"No. I was prompted by my own profit and my own interests. What effect it had on the coal mines and the public welfare is for you to estimate. That was not my motive." Mr. Moen stared dazedly about him and whispered to Paul Larkin,
"Something's gone screwy here."
"Oh, shut up," snapped Larkin.
I am sure, Mr. Reardon, said the eldest judge, that you do not really believe, nor does the public, that we wish to treat you as a sacrificial victim. If anyone has been laboring under such a misapprehension, we are anxious to prove that it is not true. The judges retired to consider their verdict. They did not stay out long. They returned to an ominously silent courtroom and announced that a fine of $5,000 was imposed on Henry Reardon, but that the sentence was suspended. Streaks of jeering laughter ran through the applause that swept the courtroom. The applause was aimed at Reardon, the laughter at the judges. Reardon stood motionless, not turning to the crowd, barely hearing the applause. He stood looking at the judges. There was no triumph in his face, no elation. Only the still intensity of contemplating a vision with a bitter wonder that was almost fear. He was seeing the enormity of the smallness of the enemy who was destroying the world. He felt as if after a journey of years through a landscape of devastation, past the ruins of great factories, the wrecks of powerful engines, the bodies of invincible men, he had come upon the despoiler, expecting to find a giant, and had found a rat, eager to scurry for cover at the first sound of a human step. If this is what has beaten us, he thought, the guilt is ours. He was jolted back into the courtroom by the people pressing to surround him. He smiled in answer to their smiles, to the frantic, tragic eagerness of their faces. There was a touch of sadness in his smile.
God bless you, Mr. Reardon, said an old woman with a ragged shawl over her head. Can't you save us, Mr. Reardon? They're eating us alive, and it's no use fooling anybody about how it's the rich that they're after. Do you know what's happening to us?
Listen, Mr. Reardon, said a man who looked like a factory worker. It's the rich who are selling us down the river. Tell those wealthy bastards who are so anxious to give everything away that when they give away their palaces, they're giving away the skin off our backs.
I know it, said Reardon.
The guilt is ours, he thought. If we who were the movers, the providers, the benefactors of mankind, were willing to let the brand of evil be stamped upon us and silently to bear punishment for our virtues, what sort of good did we expect to triumph in the world? He looked at the people around him. They had cheered him today. They had cheered him by the side of the track of the John Galt line. But tomorrow they would clamor for a new directive from Wesley Mooch and a free housing project from Orrin Boyle, while Boyle's girders collapsed upon their heads. They would do it because they would be told to forget as a sin that which had made them cheer Hank Reardon. Why were they ready to renounce their highest moments as a sin? Why were they willing to betray the best within them? What made them believe that this earth was a realm of evil, where despair was their natural fate? He could not name the reason, but he knew that it had to be named. He felt it as a huge question mark within the courtroom, which it was now his duty to answer. This was the real sentence imposed upon him, he thought, to discover what idea, what simple idea available to the simplest man, had made mankind accept the doctrines that led it to self-destruction. Hank, I'll never think that it's hopeless, not ever again, said Dagny that evening after the trial. I'll never be tempted to quit. You've proved that the right always works and always wins. She stopped, then added, provided one knows what is the right. Lillian said to him at dinner next day, so you've won, have you? Her voice was noncommittal. She said nothing else. She was watching him as if studying a riddle. The wet nurse asked him at the mills, Mr. Reardon, what's a moral premise?
What you're going to have a lot of trouble with.
The boy frowned, then shrugged and said, laughing, God, that was a wonderful show. What a beating you gave them, Mr. Reardon. I sat by the radio and howled.
How do you know it was a beating?
Well, it was, wasn't it?
Are you sure of it?
Sure, I'm sure.
The thing that makes you sure is a moral premise.
The newspapers were silent. After the exaggerated attention they had given to the case, they acted as if the trial were not worthy of notice. They printed brief accounts on unlikely pages, worded in such generalities that no reader could discover any hint of a controversial issue. The businessmen he met seemed to wish to evade the subject of his trial. Some made no comment at all, but turned away, their faces showing a peculiar resentment under the effort to appear noncommittal, as if they feared that the mere act of looking at him would be interpreted as taking a stand. Others ventured to comment, "In my opinion, Mr. Reardon, it was extremely unwise of you. It seems to me that this is hardly the time to make enemies. We can't afford to arouse resentment." "Whose resentment?" he asked.
"I don't think the government will like it."
"You saw the consequences of that."
"Well, I don't know."
"The public won't take it. There's bound to be a lot of indignation." "You saw how the public took it."
"Well, I don't know. We've been trying hard not to give any grounds for all those accusations about selfish greed, and you've given ammunition to the enemy."
"Would you rather agree with the enemy that you have no right to your profits and your property?"
"Oh, no, no, certainly not. But why go to extremes? There's always a middle ground."
"A middle ground? Between you and your murderers?"
"Now, why use such words?"
"What I said at the trial. Was it true or not?"
"It's going to be misquoted and misunderstood."
"Was it true or not?"
"The public is too dumb to grapple with such issues."
"Was it true or not?"
"It's no time to boast about being rich when the populace is starving. It's just goading them on to seize everything."
"But telling them that you have no right to your wealth while they have is what's going to restrain them?"
"Well, I don't know."
"I don't like the things you said at your trial," said another man. "In my opinion, I don't agree with you at all. Personally, I'm proud to believe that I am working for the public good, not just for my own profit. I like to think that I have some goal higher than just earning my 3 meals a day in my Hammond limousine."
"And I don't like that idea about no directives and no controls," said another. "I grant you they're running hog wild and overdoing it, but no controls at all? I don't go along with that. I think some controls are necessary, the ones which are for the public good."
"I am sorry, gentlemen," said Reardon, "that I will be obliged to save your goddamn necks along with mine." A group of businessmen headed by Mr. Moen did not issue any statements about the trial, but a week later they announced, with an inordinate amount of publicity, that they were endowing the construction of a playground for the children of the unemployed. Bertram Scudder did not mention the trial in his column, but 10 days later he wrote, among items of miscellaneous gossip, "Some idea of the public value of Mr. Hank Reardon may be gathered from the fact that of all social groups, he seems to be the most unpopular with his own fellow businessmen. His old-fashioned brand of ruthlessness seems to be too much even for those predatory barons of profit." On an evening in December, when the street beyond his window was like a congested throat, coughing with the horns of pre-Christmas traffic, Reardon sat in his room at the Wayne Falkland Hotel, fighting an enemy more dangerous than weariness or fear, revulsion against the thought of having to deal with human beings. He sat unwilling to venture into the streets of the city, unwilling to move, as if he were chained to his chair and to this room. He had tried for hours to ignore an emotion that felt like the pull of homesickness, his awareness that the only man whom he longed to see was here in this hotel, just a few floors above him. He had caught himself in the past few weeks wasting time in the lobby whenever he entered the hotel or left it, loitering unnecessarily at the mail counter or the newsstand, watching the hurried currents of people, hoping to see Francisco D'Anconia among them. He had caught himself eating solitary dinners in the restaurant of the Wayne Falkland, with his eyes on the curtains of the entrance doorway. Now he caught himself sitting in his room, thinking that the distance was only a few floors. He rose to his feet with a chuckle of amused indignation. He was acting, he thought, like a woman who waits for a telephone call and fights against the temptation to end the torture by making the first move. There was no reason, he thought, why he could not go to Francisco D'Anconia if that was what he wanted. Yet when he told himself that he would, he felt some dangerous element of surrender in the intensity of his own relief. He made a step toward the phone to call Francisco's suite, but stopped. It was not what he wanted. What he wanted was simply to walk in unannounced, as Francisco had walked into his office. It was this that seemed to state some unstated right between them. On his way to the elevator, he thought, he won't be in, or if he is, you'll probably find him entertaining some floozy which will serve you right. But the thought seemed unreal. He could not make it apply to the man he had seen at the mouth of the furnace. He stood confidently in the elevator, looking up. He walked confidently down the hall, feeling his bitterness relax into gaiety. He knocked at the door. Francisco's voice snapped, "Come in." It had a brusque, absent-minded sound. Reardon opened the door and stopped on the threshold. One of the hotel's costliest satin-shaded lamps stood in the middle of the floor, throwing a circle of light on wide sheets of drafting paper. Francisco D'Anconi, in shirt sleeves, a strand of hair hanging down over his face, lay stretched on the floor on his stomach, propped up by his elbows, biting the end of a pencil in concentration upon some point of the intricate tracing before him. He did not look up. He seemed to have forgotten the knock. Reardon tried to distinguish the drawing. It looked like the section of a smelter. He stood watching in startled wonder. Had he had the power to bring into reality his own image of Francisco D'Anconia? This was the picture he would have seen, the figure of a purposeful young worker, intent upon a difficult task. In a moment, Francisco raised his head. In the next instant, he flung his body upward to a kneeling posture, looking at Reardon with a smile of incredulous pleasure. In the next, he seized the drawings and threw them aside too hastily, face down.
"What did I interrupt?" asked Reardon.
"Nothing much. Come in."
He was grinning happily. Reardon felt suddenly certain that Francisco had waited too, had waited for this as for a victory which he had not quite hoped to achieve. "What were you doing?" asked Reardon. "Just amusing myself. Let me see it."
"No."
He rose and kicked the drawings aside. Reardon noted that if he had resented as impertinence Francisco's manner of proprietorship in his office, he himself was now guilty of the same attitude, because he offered no explanation for his visit, but crossed the room and sat down in an armchair, casually, as if he were at home. "Why didn't you come to continue what you had started?" he asked.
"You have been continuing it brilliantly without my help."
"Do you mean my trial?"
"I mean your trial."
"How do you know you weren't there?"
Francisco smiled, because the tone of the voice confessed an added sentence. "I was looking for you."
"Don't you suppose I heard every word of it on the radio?"
"You did."
"Well, how did you like hearing your own lines come over the air with me as your stooge?"
"You weren't, Mr. Reardon. They weren't my lines."
"Weren't they the things you had always lived by?"
"Yes."
"I only helped you to see that you should have been proud to live by them."
"I am glad you heard it."
"It was great, Mr. Reardon."
"And about 3 generations too late."
"What do you mean?"
"If one single businessman had had the courage then to say that he worked for nothing but his own profit, and to say it proudly, he would have saved the world."
"I haven't given up the world as lost."
"It isn't. It can never be.
But, oh God, what he would have spared us."
"Well, I guess we have to fight no matter what era we're caught in."
"Yes."
"You know, Mr. Reardon, I would suggest that you get a transcript of your trial and read what you said. Then see whether you are practicing it fully and consistently, or not."
"You mean that I'm not?"
"See for yourself."
"I know that you had a great deal to tell me when we were interrupted that night at the mills. Why don't you finish what you had to say?"
"No, it's too soon."
Francisco acted as if there were nothing unusual about this visit, as if he took it as a matter of natural course, as he had always acted in Reardon's presence. But Reardon noted that he was not so calm as he wished to appear. He was pacing the room in a manner that seemed to release for an emotion he did not want to confess. He had forgotten the lamp, and it still stood on the floor as the room's sole illumination.
"You've been taking an awful beating in the way of discoveries, haven't you?" said Francisco. "How did you like the behavior of your fellow businessmen?"
"I suppose it was to be expected."
His voice tense with the anger of compassion, Francisco said, "It's been 12 years, and yet I'm still unable to see it indifferently."
The sentence sounded involuntary. As if trying to suppress the sound of emotion, he had uttered suppressed words.
12 years. Since what?" asked Reardon.